Okay, so again, thank you for having me here. And if you came yesterday, thank you for coming again. if you were here yesterday, you saw that we hold rather unorthodox views. And what I'm going to try to show you today is that this unorthodox view helps in more places than one could have expected. So the topic I'm going to talk about has been worked out in collaboration with these people in Mexico. We have some publications on it. As you all have probably seen this diagram a million times. During the process of gravitational collapse of a black hole that forms a black hole, you may have lots of information contained in the initial state that may seem to disappear at this singularity. And if we take, for instance, the matter field in this initial hypersurface to be, for simplicity, a pure state, it seems problematic that at the late times we seem to have some mixed states represented by the Hawking radiation. Now, there is, to some extent, even a debate as to whether or not there is an information loss issue, and people's postures depend on what they assume about what happens here at the singularity, and to some extent also about what their ideas are regarding what a physical theory of quantum gravity should be, how it should be fit with our intuition of the classical universe, and to some extent even about what the physical theory should be about. People that hold, for instance, a purely epistemic view about the quantum state perhaps don't even see that there is a problem here. Will not have a reason to believe that there is a problem there. Simply observers that are not allowed to go here will miss some of the information, and that's it. The real problem emerges if, on the other hand, quantum gravity resolves the singularity. Because if quantum gravity does, if there is no way to resolve the singularity and quantum gravity doesn't do that, one may have to consider what lies there as a boundary, extra boundary of space-time. And then, of course, one can simply say, well, if this is not a Cauchy-Aper surface, should by no means contain all the information. If you draw a Cauchy surface here, that will contain all the information and there is no problem. If you wanted to talk about the information that lies on this region, then you would have to complete it to a Cauchy-Aper surface that will have to go very close to this, through the singularity, or include the singularity, or more precisely be very nearby. But of course, this point of view is not satisfactory for people that work on quantum gravity, because they in general believe that quantum gravity will resolve the singularity, perhaps as proposed in the particular approach of loop quantum gravity by these people. But anyway, they would see the inclusion of this extra boundary as not only uncalled for, but essentially as removing from consideration precisely the interesting area, region, precisely the region where for which this theory of quantum gravity is devised. On the other hand, we expect quantum gravity perhaps to produce strong and dramatic deviations from GR, but only very close to the singularity. One does not expect these changes to be dramatic elsewhere. Perhaps the only remnant that one may expect, the only trace of quantum gravity that one may expect to outlast the evaporation of the black hole would be something like a stable Planck remnant, which would naturally be a very small mass object, perhaps fractions of a gram. And of course, one does not believe that the information content that can be attributed to that object can be very large, because if it's a very it's a relatively small mass object, one cannot expect it to have an enormous amount of information. For instance, something similar to the original star that collapsed and led to the black hole, because this object, as I said, would be very, very light. So one does not believe in general that this would anything of that sort would play an important role regarding what is the information that one may recover afterwards, and I will not discuss much this alternative here. So the puzzle is that if quantum gravity removes the singularity and the need to incorporate an extra boundary, then the quantum state at late times should be, according to quantum mechanics, unitarily related to the quantum state at early times. And the problem, of course, is that reconciling this expectation with the precise picture that emerges from considerations based on general relativity and quantum field theory in regimes where these two theories are we have no reason to expect that these two theories should not be valid, has proven extremely difficult. We know, for instance, that some recent proposals that involve a quantum gravity, there is an issue regarding signature change in the metric, or in other words, fluctuations around zero on the conformal factor, which is another way of saying signature change. We don't know if there is a way out, but it seems very, very difficult. Other proposals, as you would probably have heard, such as the black hole complementarity ideas, led to firewalls, etc. So this is a picture that would one in which one would like to address the issue if, in truth, we accept that quantum gravity resolves the singularity. In other words, this region here would not be taken as singular, but would have to be taken as a region that needs, for its precise description of things that occur inside it, a quantum theory of gravity, which of course we will take the view that we don't know what it is. One of the aspects of the problem is that Hawking radiation is expected to take a lot of the original energy into late times of Scry Plus, but before the boundary of the future of the singularity, if we want. And therefore, to the future of the singularity, one is expected to have very, very little energy, as I said, but on the other hand, it should have a lot of information, and that's the problem with the remnant. Okay, so our approach is to consider the issue based on these modified versions of quantum theory, and one could say, well, you know, if you're considering a modified version of quantum theory in which you violate the unitary evolution, then of course you will not have a problem. But of course it's very interesting to see exactly what in detail how does this happen, and in particular it's not obvious that you can do this at both the qualitative and quantitative level. So let me remind you that quantum mechanics is a theory that although extremely successful, has a serious problem, which is known as the measurement problem. Basically, the issue is that we have two evolution laws. One evolution law, completely unitary and deterministic, that is supposed to control the evolution of states while nobody is making a measurement. And on the other hand, upon a measurement of a certain observable O, the state is supposed to jump to one of the eigenstates of this observable with a certain probability. And the problem is precisely what is a measurement. If you want to apply quantum theory to everything, the problem, of course, is what is a measurement. In other words, when, according to the theory, should we use this law of evolution or this law of evolution? And of course, there are many approaches to the subject. Yesterday we discussed some of the problems that we find, at least in the application to situations like we were discussing yesterday, or even to the situation we are discussing today. But let me not go through that. Again, let me just, for you, those that you were not there yesterday, let me just illustrate a couple, the issue with a couple of quotes. This one I like very much. It's by John Bell, and says, either the wave function as controlled by the Schrodinger equation is not everything or is not right, suggesting that there is not everything, that there is something like hidden variables or something like that, or is not right, suggesting that we need to modify its form. Steven Weinberg, in an interview this early this year, a radio interview, said, I think the best hope at this point is to find some successor theory to which quantum mechanics as we know it is only a good approximation. Roger Penrose has been arguing for a long time that in attempting to join quantum mechanics and general relativity, we may have to modify both, not just adapt GR to quantum mechanics, but do something to quantum mechanics as well. And he also noted very early on that something like a dynamical reduction in the matter sector may be required for a self-consistency of a theory involving black holes in thermodynamic statistical equilibrium with other systems. This is a very paper from the early 80s. Okay, so we will try to see how this will work in a particular theory. This modified versions of quantum mechanics that have been designed to deal with the measurement problem have a long history, going back to Philip Perl, Giraldi Rimini-Weber, Lajos Diossi, Roger Penrose, as I mentioned, Weinberg got interested lately. And there are a few relativistic versions, at least three relativistic proposals by these people. These are very recent works. And we will not work with those because they are, even though they resemble to some extent what the theory I will present, they become much harder to work with. So the example that I'm going to use is the same theory we employed yesterday, which is called continuous spontaneous localization. And this theory is controlled by a modified Schrodinger equation, whose solution, this is better to write it in terms of the solution of the equation rather than the equation. It's a little bit more, makes it easier to read what happens. The state is supposed to evolve, if you prepare your initial state at some time zero, the state at the time t is going to be, is obtained by, the standard time order operator acting on this exponential that contains the Hamiltonian. So this would be the standard Schrodinger evolution, corrected by this term, which in normal situations will be very small, is a term that contains three elements, a stochastic function, a real value stochastic function of time, a parameter lambda, and an operator A. And of course, the evolution of the state then depends on which particular realization of the function WT happens to occur in nature, and the probability rule is now not given in the standard way, but is the what you need now is the probability rule, since the evolution now is in some sense deterministic except for the stochastic function. The probability rule is a rule that tells you what is the probability of this stochastic function, and is given by this expression. The theory has been designed in the sense to unify these two evolution processes in a single one, corresponding to the observable A. So what this theory does is for long times, it will drive the state to eigenstates of the operator A. Which one of the eigenstates? We don't know. It's going to be determined by the particular realization of the function W that happens to occur in our universe. The proposal in the non-relativistic context is that these operators A are the smear positions of all the of the particles involved, one for each particle. And this parameter lambda has to be small enough not to conflict with the high precision test of quantum mechanics in subatomic physics or even in mesoscopic physics, and big enough to provide for a rapid localization of macroscopic objects to basically rule out Schrödinger cat states, or to ensure that Schrödinger cats collapse rapidly to one of the macroscopic eigenstates. And the proposal is that this number should be of the order of 10 to the minus 16 seconds to the minus 1. There is a lot of room there to wiggle, but not infinite. I mean, you can go a couple of orders of magnitude up or down, but not infinite amounts. That's all that you need, you can do. Okay, so we need to adapt this theory to situations involving quantum fields and gravitation. The first thing to note again is that these theories are all these dynamical reduction theories require the notion of time. Collapse takes place in time, and as quantum gravity has a problem of time, we need, if we want to talk about such theories, to involve passing to a sort of semi-classical regime. So we will be assuming that one can rely on the semi-classical framework. Of course, this is precisely the regime in which we are interested in resolving the problem. Is at that level, at the level of a space-time picture, that we want to have a resolution of the information paradox. Again, we consider at the deepest levels gravitation must be a quantum mechanical, but at the macro and meso scales it must correspond, as described by a metric satisfying Einstein equation, it must be taken as an emergent phenomena in the same spirit as hydrodynamics is emergent from the atomic and molecular physics, and that there could be some traces of the quantum regime that will survive in some sense as an effective dynamical state reduction for matter fields that is parameterized by the theory. Okay, we can expect to be able to trust this classical geometric description to be a good approximation as long as we are far away from the Planck, from regimes in which we have large Planck curvatures, Planck scale curvatures. Okay, so now let me say a word about something that is important to have clear here. Concerning what we, pure mixed proper and improper states. We will take the view that an individual system that is not entangled with other systems is represented by a pure state. This will simplify our discussion. We may not need to take this all the way. But it's certainly the situation which we want to consider the problem at hand. So according to this view, mixed states will occur when either we consider an ensemble, and that would be a proper mixed state representing an ensemble of identical systems, each one of which is in a pure state. This terminology is borrowed from Spaniat. And then there are improper mixed states, which is the state of a subsystem of a larger system that is in a pure state after we trace over some of its degrees of freedom. These two things are conceptually, ontologically very different kind of things. An example of this state is, for example, Minkowski vacuum, as represented after we trace over one side of the Rindler space-time, and we have then the Unruh thermal state. So an ordinary thermal state will be, as in statistical mechanics, an ensemble where the weights happen to be characterized by temperature, chemical potentials, and things of that sort. And an improper thermal state would be, as I said, something that is a mixed state of this sort, but where the weights happen to be thermal, as the Unruh effect I just mentioned. So resolving the black hole information paradox requires explaining how a pure state, the initial pure state, becomes an ordinary thermal state rather than an improper one, simply because the inside region of the black hole will disappear. So to treat all these issues, we will use, of course, a toy model. It's going to be based on the two-dimensional CGHS black hole model, a toy version of CSL adapted to quantum field theory in curved spacetime, some simplifying assumptions, natural and simplifying assumptions about quantum gravity and what happens when it cures the singularity. And the extra assumption is that the CSL parameter, this lambda parameter, which we took as fixed, or it's normally taken as fixed, depends locally on the space-time curvature. Yes?
There's a question about different kinds of states. It would seem to me that information of black hole, you know, if you exclude information inside the black hole, that's correspond to type B, it's an improper state. Right? I mean,
that's true before, if we are describing the state here, right? The state, if I associate with this hypersurface, the state here, of course, this state would be pure and in normal situation, the normal description. Only if I trace over the degrees of freedom inside the horizon, I get a mixed state. But the problem is what happens when I want to describe the state here at very light times. I don't no longer have the inside of the black hole. So if I'm going to address it in this way, I need to explain why the state here is such a mixed, pure mixed state, because this region is not longer part of the story. That's the issue. Yep.
We need to know what's inside the black hole.
Sorry?
Some models of black holes are just vacuum inside.
Well, this one, you can have basically vacuum. You can have black holes formed by gravitational waves, and you would have vacuum. Except, of course, at some point there will be a singularity.
Well, because it's a sitter vacuum, there's no singularity.
Okay, I'm talking about so let me talk about the standard type of black hole in which is formed by the collapse of some matter that enters the black hole, and then we will have a singularity.
That's an assumption.
What's an assumption?
Well, the main assumption, you have a standard model.
Well, I'm concerned about that. I'm going to be interested in those black holes.
It's not true.
Fine, we have something else. I don't know what it is, this something else, but I'm concerned about this situation in which we have a star that collapses and forms a black hole.
The question of singularity is a separate issue because classical singularity theorems rely on energy conditions which are violated.
That's true.
Field theory, so.
That's true. Yes.
So there's no necessary conclusion.
I agree. It's not necessary. Nevertheless, there seems to be, that doesn't seem to be able to resolve the issue.
Oh, in fact, it doesn't in itself resolve the issue.
Yeah. Okay, so this is the context in which we will try to address this issue. As I said, some early ideas were mentioned by Robert Penrose very early on, and some related aspects have been contemplated by Unruh and Wald in a paper a decade ago. Sorry, this is not a decade, this is 2 decades ago. Okay, so let me review for you this very nice model. It's extremely useful because it's a two-dimensional model in which most of the calculations can be done explicitly, so this is very useful to use in this context, and nevertheless you get an interesting space-time with all the features that you need to deal with the problem we are interested in. So this involves space, the standard Einstein-Hilbert term, but modified by a dilaton-type term. This is essential in two dimensions to ensure that you have non-trivial dynamics, the cosmological constant-like term, and then the quantum, the field that is going to be our probe field, our interesting, the field of interest, and which we will treat quantum mechanically, is the field F, which is minimally coupled. And one of the features of the that makes the model particularly easy to work with is that we working in the conformal gauge, one can use null coordinates, and without loss of any generality, this is the space-time. Space-time can be described in that way, the full space-time. The field F decouples from the variable rho, and in fact, all solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation have this form, this simple form. These are null coordinates, and these are then right-moving and left-moving solutions with any form for the functions f plus and f minus. The solution that it corresponds to a pulse of matter falling in falling due to its own gravitational self-interaction is given by this metric. In the early times where this theta function is zero, one can see that changing variables, one gets basically a flat metric. So before this pulse, we have what is called the dilaton vacuum solution, and after this null collapsing pulse, what we have is a black hole solution. The diagram, the conformal diagram for the system is this. So we have this pulse falling in, a singularity forms, and into the path of the singularity we have the horizon. One can, in fact, write the metric in different regions, in particular forms. In the black hole region, one can write it in this fashion and compute very easily the Ricci curvature scalar and find where exactly the singularity is located. So it's located at this hyperboloid given by the zero of the denominator here. In the dilaton vacuum region, as I said, passing to changing variables, to logarithms, when the metric becomes flat in null coordinates. And in the Schwarzschild, exterior Schwarzschild region, in the stereo black hole region, one has something that looks very similar to Schwarzschild-like coordinates, and something similar can be done in the interior. Okay. So with all this, one proceeds to write the quantum theory for the field F. We will have, as we said, two independent sectors, the left moving sector and the right moving sector. We will use the past asymptotic infinity in the left for the right moving modes as initial data for the right moving modes, and vice versa for the other modes. And therefore, past asymptotic null infinity is going to be our in region. In the in region, doing the quantization in the natural in region space-time, one has a natural basis of positive and negative energies, and one proceeds to the standard quantization. So this is the expression of the quantum field operator in terms of creation annihilation operators for the right and left moving modes, and these modes are simply plane waves moving to the right and moving to the left, and the vacuum for our theory is simply the vacuum for the right moving modes and the vacuum for the in moving modes, and that would be, except for the incoming pulse, the initial state of the system. It will be convenient to use instead of these plane wave modes, to think about it in terms of some localized wave packages, so then one can talk clearly about late times and early times. We will not be very explicit in this sense. Also, one can do the quantum field description at late times in terms of the creation and annihilation for the right moving and left moving modes Again, this can be done explicitly. Now it has to be done for the exterior modes and for the modes inside the horizon. So let me just go back quick here. So we will have some modes that are associated with this region and some modes that are associated with this region. And if you want, I'm putting data here. Okay. And then we have to. What we know is that how to compute the describe the initial vacuum state in terms of this late time quantization that is done by the standard Bogoliubov transformation, and we are going to be interested only in the right moving sector, which is the one that in which non-trivial things happen. This transformation is what accounts for the Hawking flux. In other words, if I trace over the interior degrees of freedom, as Professor Bardeen was mentioning, well, I will get a thermal state, the Hawking state. So one can explicitly write the state. The state is basically the right moving vacuum, and in the left moving, I have everything is in the vacuum except for a left moving pulse, which is a high excitation of one of these wave packets. The state can then be written as a sum of occupation numbers in terms of the late time notion of particles, in which the all sorts of modes are present, with weights that happen to have that the stand well which asymptotically have that the standard thermal characteristics of the Hawking radiation. So again, if I write this state, I trace over the internal degrees of freedom of the black hole. I have Hawking radiation. So now, with this in hand, we are now in a position to see what CSL tells us about this. In order to apply CSL theory, which involves a modification of the time evolution of quantum states, we need to have a foliation of our space-time and define some sort of global time parameter. We are going to consider, since we are considering modified evolution, we are going to separate the standard evolution and call it free evolution. Actually, it's free because our state, our field is a free field, and use a type of interaction picture in which the modifications due to the CSL part are going to drive the evolution of the states. In other words, the quantum field is going to be the same as before, but now the states, instead of being independent of time, are going to evolve according to the CSL evolution. So I separated the evolution in these two parts and use interaction picture. Of course, in a relativistic context, one would have something like a Tomonaga-Schwinger type interaction picture evolution, in which which would explicitly indicate that resulting evolution is independent of the foliation of space-time. But in the version that we are working here, we don't yet have this precise form. Okay, to make things easier, and since I'm going to be assuming that the parameter controlling the CSL evolution depends on curvature, it's convenient to foliate space-time by lines that are at least in the inside where the curvature can become very large, lines of constant curvature. So we have made this foliation explicitly. You can foliate this internal space-time by lines of constant curvature and join them to lines of constant Schwarzschild-like time in the exterior by interpolating in an appropriate way. And now that I have the foliation and I can therefore evolve the states, I need to be more precise about the CSL evolution. The CSL evolution equations that I showed you before corresponded to a one-dimensional one-particle system. So when we have many a multiplicity of particles, you can generalize the theory to include any large collection of any collection of compatible observables as driving the collapse evolution. And of course, now we will have not only one function, one stochastic function, but we will have one stochastic function for each one of the operators. And now we will make we will continue to work making some simplifying assumptions. The assumptions are going to be, first of all, that the collapse operators collapse the state into states of definite number of particles in the inside. And as I said, we're going to work in the interaction picture, so the Hamiltonian needs to be removed from this equation. So this is the evolution equation with H gone and X replaced by the number operator in each, for each mode NJ of my field. We will assume, therefore, that the rate of collapse is the standard value that I mentioned before, this 10 to the minus 16 seconds to the minus 1, or whatever it needs to be for the system to the theory to work in laboratory context, and it's going to be corrected by something that goes like the Ricci curvature to some positive power. In four dimensions, we expect something to go like the Weyl tensor square or something of that form. I can explain later why. And since the hypersurfaces over which the modifications of the evolutions are hypersurfaces of constant R, those hypersurfaces are going to be labeled by a parameter tau. Our parameter now becomes an effective function of tau inside the black hole and basically zero in the outside or negligible in the outside. And the point of this is to ensure that the theory achieves in the finite time to the singularity what normal collapse theories achieved in an infinite amount of time. Okay, I lost my control. How am I doing on time?
Another 20 minutes.
Oh, okay. Okay, so now the role for quantum gravity. As I said, we don't know what the quantum gravity theory is, but we will assume that first of all, it cures the singularity and leads on the other side to some reasonable space-time. We will assume that quantum gravity does not lead to large violations of basic conservation laws. And if we look at the energetics in the region just before the singularity, we see that we have the positive flux corresponding to the shell that formed the black hole, the flux negative energy that was mentioned also by Professor Bardeen, coming the counterpart of the Hawking radiation, and the Hawking radiation going to infinity. Looking at the energetics, it's very clear that if energy is going to be conserved, the sum of the things that are falling into the high curvature region have to add up to a very small amount of energy, because basically all the energy has gone into the Hawking radiation. So if that's the case, then the region after the singularity must be basically a region with a very small amount of energy, something perhaps that can be associated with some remnant energy or some Planck mass remnant. But for simplicity, as we said, we will ignore the possibility of information or of energy associated with this thing. For simplicity, we will consider that as a zero energy momentum region, energy momentum in an effective sense, and we will denote that space-time as basically the post-singularity vacuum. So the complete characterization of the evolution of our theory is, First of all, the collapse theory will ensure that my initial state will collapse to one of the eigenstates of the number operators in the inside. So instead of a sum, I will have just one of the components. Now quantum gravity is going to combine the infalling poles plus the infalling stuff and produce something, and the infalling matter, and produce something that is the post-singularity vacuum. Right? So this infalling amount of particles in the particular state is going to be combined with the poles and produce something that can have basically no energy. And this is the state that we have. This, of course, is a pure state, but that is a state that is undetermined by the theory, because I don't know what is the particular realization of all the W and J functions. So the particular realization is going to determine which one of these states it is. And again, since I cannot predict which one it is, I'm going to do a statistical analysis and will consider an ensemble of systems. This is an ensemble of systems identically prepared in the same initial state. So that is the initial state of the poles with the initial vacuum. That state is pure, even though it represents now an ensemble. The density matrix that represents that pulse is this one. And now I can convert my CSL evolution equations into an equation that evolves my density matrix, basically summing over all possible realizations of the collapse functions, of the W functions, with their corresponding weight. That leads to a sort of Lindblad equation that can be solved explicitly. One can solve explicitly what is the form of the state. And one can see that the evolution is basically contains these operators, these number operators. This is not left moving or right moving, it's acting on the left and acting on the right on the density matrix. The density matrix, my initial density matrix, was basically, was my in state, which has this form, has of course all sorts of non-diagonal terms. This quantity, this measure of the number of states gives me basically the energy associated with the number of states and with the occupation number in the late time, and the fact that this integral diverges as I integrate from very early times until very close to the singularity will ensure that only the case in which there is nj for these two sides is the same, only those terms will survive. Basically, this is the expression that we will obtain for the density matrix at late time. That ensures that the off-diagonal terms disappears due to the divergence of this integral, which is again only the result of the fact that curvature, as curvature increases, the rate of destruction of information associated with CSL is increasing. Therefore, at the end of the, as we approach the singularity, the non-diagonal terms disappear. This is not decoherence, this is actual collapse, shouldn't be confused, and we have this end state. But now I go through the singularity and use what I said about what quantum gravity does after the singularity. Well, it replaces the state containing almost no energy and almost no and no information by the post-singularity vacuum. And I end up, therefore, with a state which is basically a thermal state representing the ensemble of the Hawking radiation at infinity and basically a vacuum in the region plus post the singularity. We started therefore with an initial pure state representing an ensemble of systems, all of them preparing the same identical state, and ended up with a proper thermal state following representing the scribe, the field at scribe plus, and a vacuum region in the empty regime. In other words, we obtain what is normally thought to be a problem. Information seems to have disappeared. Here we say information will disappear. That is not a problem because that's not a feature only of black holes. This information disappears all the time in association with what we normally call a measurement. The only thing about the black hole is that as curvature increases, as I approach the singularity, the rate of erasing of this information increases dramatically, and therefore I erase all the information that was in the initial state. Of course, this at this point is just a toy model. One would have to do an analysis in a fully relativistic setting, but we believe this is a very interesting path to resolving this conundrum known as the black hole information paradox, which we think is milder, requires milder assumptions or leads to milder conclusions than what seem to be out there as alternatives. Now, let me finish with a very speculative idea. All these results have been backed by explicit calculations, but let me finish with an speculative idea, which I cannot back up with more than that. If we accept that black holes erase information in a fashion like I just described, and I imagine that the theory of quantum gravity will eventually involve something like radiative corrections involving all possibilities as quantum field theories have taught us, it's not unnatural to think that those corrections would involve also virtual black holes. And those virtual black holes that may be appearing in all times, in all situations, would be erasing information at all times and in every situation. Perhaps it's those effects of those virtual black holes that is being represented in these effective CSL type theories as the terms that produce the deviation from unitarity and the departure from the standard Schrödinger evolution. So this would lead to a close, self-consistent picture of the world that, from my point of view, is much more appealing than what is offered in other proposals. So let me finish here.
Which was totally misinterpreted. What he said was that the event horizon occurs in the infinite null future, according to external observer. It's not real. But there's an apparent horizon, and he makes the apparent horizon fluctuate so information can serve. So a lot of this has to do with what we assume about the event horizon, which we've never seen yet, and what goes on inside of it by the singularities. Because the matter all falls through to the singularity, gravitational collapse. There's nothing really in between the singularity and the event horizon.
Well, there is a lot of curvature. There's a lot of curvature increasing as I start approaching the singularity. Well, in the standard description, if you look at the standard Schwarzschild collapse of matter, the exterior region of the matter is described, due to Birkhoff's theorem, is described by the Schwarzschild solution, even in the exterior region. That region even if it's empty, has a divergent value of Weyl curvature square. That's precisely why we think Weyl curvature is more interesting than Ricci scalar, because it diverges not only when I follow matter toward the singularity, but even when I follow vacuum spacetime towards the singularity. So there is something going on. The curvature is increasing, at least in the standard picture, right? If we deviate from the standard picture, okay, that would be a very different theory. We don't have to be married to any specific theory, but on the other hand, we have good reasons to trust GR as at least a very good approximation in regimes like the one involving a black hole. Sorry?
All experimental tests.
That's true, but you could be inside the horizon even if the field is extremely weak. Black holes of very large masses will have fields that are extremely weak. Curvature will be extremely small, perhaps smaller than in this room, and you would be inside a black hole. So I find a scheme in which I would find dramatic deviations strange. Sure.
It seems to me that the performance and information paradox only quite reached the singularity in the sense that you have, say, an evaporating black hole, and if it evaporates by some substantial fraction, but it's still very classical. The geometry is still very classical, yeah, still curvature. Then, so you get past what's called the page time. So you get past the point at which the standard Eckstein-Hawking entropy is smaller than the entropy of the
remaining stuff. Yep.
So you have this problem that you have, an object with readily, not enough energy to get here, not enough, in some sense, to contain
all that information. I agree. So if I look at the hypersurface here, an hypersurface here, that's the situation.
Now, did you just accept that? I mean.
No, one of the good things of this scheme is precisely that as you start approaching the singularity, you are also decreasing the information. The information does not disappear here. The information starts disappearing here. Here is already much less information than because it was being erased by this collapse theory. So the information that you have here is disappearing as you move on here, outside here, at this very slow rate that we know has to be the slow rate that is compatible with experiments in the lab. Extremely small rate. Here is the outside, very small. Here is still also very slowly disappearing, but you start moving up here, the information starts being erased. So if you look very close to the singularity here, all the information has been erased at that point. That's what this scheme provides, which I also feel is a.
What I'm saying is that before you get very close to the singularity, you might be in a regime, right? Or some what time surface to take. And also,
here.
The black hole, most of the entropy is in the. It's not in the classic matter, it's in the Hawking partners. Because, the matter entropy is. Is typically orders of magnitude less than the Eckstein-Hawking entropy.
Uh-huh.
The class from the star that formed the black hole has entropy which is orders of magnitude less than the Eckstein-Hawking entropy.
Yep.
So most of the entropy, eventually inside the black hole, is in the form of Hawking partners, and it sort of dribbles in gradually rather than.
Yeah, but in this scheme that we propose, there is a lot of, if you want, entropy creation occurring here. precisely because there is information being erased. There are random choices being made by nature associated with this region here at an increasingly rapid pace. So there is actual entropy being created if you wanted to look at this hypersurface here. Not necessarily inside the matter, in the quantum fields outside.
Sure. So my only point is that I still have a situation in which you have a partly evaporated black hole, but still very large compared to Planck scale.
Here.
Where the amount of entropy, according to the center set across the picture, is, you know, before it's been destroyed, it is larger than the complex Planck scale.
So an hypersurface like this one here, an hypersurface like this one that I'm marking with my red point, that's, you know, early part of the evaporation, and you want to consider the entropy associated with what with that whole hypersurface, or you want to consider the entropy associated with the outside?
So at some late time, you know, fairly late time.
Fairly late time. Okay, here.
But
here.
Macroscopic, but has evaporated a substantial amount.
Yeah.
Then without assuming destruction of information, you have an apparent problem that you have, reason for more quantum reason for inside the black hole. The one that given by the Beckerson-Hawking entropy, you believe that's limit. Or do you believe that Beckerson-Hawking entropy is a limit in some sense as to the entropy of number of quantum degrees of freedom?
Well, I think one needs to analyze exactly to what one is associating entropy. Because as long as I am considering the whole hypersurface, both the Cauchy hypersurface, both including the inside and the outside, if I start talking about Hawking entropy, then
never reach a region of high curvature.
Fine, but why? How do I compute the entropy associated with this hypersurface? What's the way I compute that entropy? Normally, I say, well, let me ignore the things behind the horizon, and let me somehow trace over those degrees of freedom, and I expect those to be something like the area, or actually bounded by the area.
Bounded by the area, right?
I don't think you will exceed that problem, or that at least that you will have a bigger problem than normally, because the entropy here, all what this theory is doing is increasing the entropy in the inside, certainly remaining within viable quantum states. So I don't see what's the, but I'm happy to look at it, right? Because I mean, what should I make of the area as identification with the entropy? Is what? Is the entropy associated with any hypersurface? Is the entropy associated with the interior? Is the entropy associated with the maximum interior or with the actual interior?
It's the entropy of your type B, and, you know, where you result of tracing over the interior.
Tracing over the interior. Okay, no. When you trace over the interior, then you will have the picture as you trace over the interior regarding the outside. The picture has not changed. The picture outside the space-time has all basically not changed, because the rate of collapse outside space-time is very small. So the effect of the quantum state in the outside is negligible. So if you trace and did the standard calculations regarding the situation outside, you will find exactly the same results as you find always.
But right. The number of degrees of freedom on some nice, what they call nice, a nice slice, which never gets close to the singularity.
Okay, but then are you going to trace over them, or you're not going to trace over them?
Well, if you don't trace over them.
If you don't trace over them, then you're going to get perhaps a smaller number for the entropy than the maximum.
So generally be smaller, but the point is, for an evaporating black hole, in principle that entropy could be larger than the Beckerson-Hawking entropy.
I don't see why.
because re-shocking photons, say, you create, there's a bit of energy, a bit of quantum information, which goes into the black hole.
Which normally you would trace over, which normally you would trace over, and now you're just modifying the state.
I'm not tracing over it. So I'm trying to count it on one of these nice slices. And by the time the black hole is evaporated, say to a tenth of its original radius, then the number of quantum bits inside the black hole will be greater than the Kleksner-Hark entropy of the black hole at that smaller radius.
I don't see that. I don't see why they would be larger. Simply because I modify the state in the inside?
Well, because the entropy of the Hark radiation is larger than the Kleksner-Hark.
Sorry, I just interrupt. So
anyway,
we should have a private discussion here. So are there any other urgent questions? And otherwise, we would continue that discussion.
Have you resolved the information loss paradox or not?
I think I have. I wouldn't call it resolve, I would call it diffuse. I have diffused it, it's no longer a paradox. Information is lost. In this scheme, information is lost, but it's not a paradox.
It's not a paradox.
Now, whether this is a proposal. Whether this is correct or not, nature will have to say. One of the concrete predictions of this scheme is that if you start doing experiments in high curvature regions, you are going to start seeing, you know, the rate of collapse become dramatic. If you fall into a black hole with a interferometer, quantum interferometer, you are going to start seeing interference disappear.
Are you willing to do this experiment?
If you fund it.
I volunteer.
If you fund it, I volunteer.
So are there any other questions or comments? Otherwise, I would say thank the speaker again.
Thank you.